morning, everyone. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, specifically Section 244103, Colorado Revised Statutes. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, 2017, and the time is 10 a.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. I'm Deputy Secretary of State Suzanne Steyer. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on June 10, 2017. Seated to my far left is Andrea Geiger, our Department Rulemaking Manager of the Administration Division. Immediately to my left is Melissa Polk, the Legal Unit Manager for the Elections Division. And to my right is Dwight Shellman, County Support Manager for the Elections Division. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the notice, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider rule revisions necessary to ensure proper administration of legislation recently passed by the Colorado General Assembly, establish uniformity in the administration of current law, organizing existing rules for clarity, eliminating obsolete provisions, simplifying the language of existing rule, removing language that is duplicative of statute, and ensuring consistency with department rulemaking standards. The Secretary of State released a preliminary draft of proposed rules with the notice of rulemaking. On July 6, 2017, revised proposed draft rules were made available to the public. Both drafts are available on the office website. Copies of the notice of rulemaking, revised draft statement of basis, and revised draft rules are available on the table in the back of the room. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. The meeting is audio recorded, and all comments become part of the official legal record. This hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at the hearing, there are sign-up sheets on the table at the back of the room. You must sign up in order to testify. For the record, our office has received written comments on the proposed rules. All comments received will become part of the official record for this hearing and will be posted online. Additionally, we will leave comment period open until Tuesday, July 18th to allow submission of additional written comments. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data, views, or arguments on amendments to the election rules in writing and, if desired, orally. The hearing is scheduled to conclude by 12 p.m., and we are limiting testimony to 5 minutes in order to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to speak, although there may be follow-up questions from any member of the committee. In the interest of time, I would request that you avoid simply repeating the testimony of others. And when you speak, please introduce yourself for the recording when you begin. If you represent an organization, please identify the organization. All right, the first person we have signed up is Merlin Klotz from Douglas County.
Good morning.
Thank you, Susan. I ask that the proposed Rule 25 and all rules relating to the so-called RLA be withdrawn entirely. The statutory definition of RLA, of risk limiting audit, is: risk limiting audit means an audit protocol that makes use of statistical methods and is designed to limit to acceptable levels the risk of certifying a preliminary election outcome that constitutes an incorrect outcome. Rule 11.3 and current post-election audit protocols meet the statutory definition. The current protocol already utilizes statistical methods in the post-election audit. The Berkeley theory is an unwieldy, unworkable method of applying statistical methods that adds nothing to the limiting risk. I shall discuss the practical aspects of the Berkeley theory. Brett will discuss the statistical aspects, and Kyle will discuss the operational aspects. The Berkeley theory is truly a solution searching for a problem. No one evaluated the current audit protocol using statistical methods to determine if there was a problem before falling in love with the romantic-sounding name of risk-limiting audit, as applied in the Berkeley theory. I did. I'm a CPA, and I've designed and implemented hundreds of audit protocols. An audit protocol requires the consideration of processes in its entirety, not just consideration of a single element. Let me give you an analogy. The Berkeley theory is the same as using a statistical method to examine the lock in your front door to establish a 95% probability that you won't be burglarized, but it ignores the fact that all the windows are open. In contrast, an audit protocol considers that both the front door and back door are locked, makes sure the windows are closed and locked, considers that all property is surrounded by a 10-foot chain link fence topped with an electrified razor wire that is surrounded by a moat filled with piranha. Consideration of the entirety of the situation provides a 99.99% probability that your house will not be burglarized. Real life example. Arthur Anderson was doing an audit, and I was the client. Using statistical methods, they selected and traced 100 transactions from purchase order to payment. They finished the audit and were leaving when I challenged their audit protocol because they neglected to do a bank reconciliation. The bank was out of balance by more than $1 million. In this case of the Colorado elections, the audit protocol considers that the SOS selects and installs the software, equipment software in secured area. The area is under video surveillance. Internal, external LATs are performed. Bipartisan teams do resolution. Post-election audits and canvas boards are performed using statistical methods. No single element in the protocol in our current protocol establishes confidence, but taken as a whole, confidence is established. An audit protocol must consider the entirety of the situation, not just a single element. When actually tested, our current methods achieve 99.99% confidence that the entire ballot is accurately reported, so nothing is gained in painfully working a single element to a 95% confidence. Proponents of the Berkeley theory note in risk-limiting post-election audits why and how that applying the Berkeley theory in a central scan is extremely difficult. The Berkeley process is not a process that is readily applicable or statistically beneficial to Colorado's election activities. This is stated by the authors. Some jurisdictions' heavy use of vote-by-mail ballots can complicate batch-level audits. That is an understatement. Our estimation is that to apply the Berkeley theory to last November's entire ballot with 50 contests on a contest-by-contest basis would require the pulling of 300% of our batches, causing a royal cluster and likely challenging the integrity of the voted ballots. When I challenged the committee as to how a contest for Congressional District 4 that resides in 22 counties would be tested, there was no answer. As an admission of this problem, the decision was made to only look for a single statewide or countywide issue to test. That potentially may attain a 95% confidence index on that race, but 0% confidence index on any other race on the ballot. That logic is the same as saying the lock on my door is safe, therefore the lock on every neighbor door in my block is safe. The Berkeley theory is based on a faulty premise. The hand counts produce superior results to machine counts. And I quote, computer software cannot be guaranteed to be perfect or secure, so voting systems should be software independent. That concept went out with the flat earth theory. From a practical perspective, it's obvious that the Berkeley theory adds nothing to our election protocol, and accordingly, Rule 25 and all related rules changes should be deleted. As a CPA, and having taken more statistics class than I ever wanted to, I understand the application of statistical methods. Because the Berkeley theory remained a solution in search of a problem, and no effort was made to define or determine if a problem even existed, I engaged two PhDs who understand statistic theory far better than myself to compare and contrast our current protocol with the Berkeley theory. There may still be a few jurisdictions that rely on precinct-level voting and tabulation that would benefit from the Berkeley theory. Generally speaking, that approach also went out with the punch card voting machines. The theory provides no benefit or added confidence to the tight and secure Colorado election central scan system. Again, I ask the Secretary to consider my entire submittal and delete proposed Rule 25 in its entirety as the existing process meets statutory requirements and the Berkeley theory provides less than certainty than any other methods. Thank you.
Do you have any? No. Okay. All right, thank you. Oh, no, I just didn't know if anybody had any questions. All right, Brett Mers.
Good afternoon, sir, ladies and gentlemen. I am Dr. Brett Mers, the elections deputy for Douglas County, and I'll just be commenting on some of the comments that Merlin made here. we looked at the process and the proposed solution, and there were some unstated assumptions behind the RLA or Berkeley process. One of the assumptions unstated was that there is a current problem in your process. So we looked at your entire process from start to finish, and quite frankly, found it to be quite secure. We did a hypergeometric analysis on the process and found that we have about a 99% likelihood of catching any miscounted ballots in the current audit process that you use. So the fact that there is an assumed problem with your current process, I challenge as being an unfounded assumption. The process as you have it that already, I use the term CSAP, Colorado SOS Audit Protocol. The CSAP that runs from the beginning of your process, the ballot creation, all the way to the certification, is a quite secure, quite valuable process. There doesn't seem to be any major issues with it. The second unfounded assumption regarding the particular RLA approach that was being considered, Merlin already mentioned that computer software cannot be guaranteed to be perfect or secure, therefore shouldn't be involved in elections. This is analogous to saying that cars are not 100% guaranteed, therefore they shouldn't be involved in transportation. Up against a perfect standard, sure, no, nothing is perfect. Up against the reality and the operational side of counting votes, the computer is exactly what you need. If you go back into the one thing that computers do better than human beings is count large data sets. In the final analysis, that's probably the only thing computers do better than humans. The human mind is designed to focus its limited conscious abilities on change, because if the change in shadow or the change in sound or the change in anything happened to be a saber-toothed tiger that you missed, it was a moot issue after that. So the mind focuses on change. In other words, when something becomes rote and rote process, it quickly gets sloughed off into the unconscious mind. That's why we, as creatures, don't do well in tabulating large data sets consistently over time. One of the first computers ever built was ENIAC, and it specifically is titled the Electrical Numerical Integrator and Calculator. It was funded by the U.S. Army to calculate ballistic trajectories, in other words, to run large data set calculations over and over and over again. The Turing machine that Alan Turing designed in Britain to break the German Enigma code simply was able to calculate large data sets faster and more consistently than human mind could, which is what allowed the Allies to break the German code. In other words, that's what these systems do, is they calculate large data sets over and over and over again with very little problem. So if you're going to actually audit something in a relevant process, it would be to make sure that your computer systems or your tabulation systems are actually working as designed. Your current protocol does that. You run an ILAT, you run a PLAT, you run an election, and then immediately you check your systems again. Based on that protocol, statistically, you have a 99% plus chance of catching any miscounted ballots. And again, your protocol, as it stands, covers it from A to B. If you've ever done any sort of change management process, the during cycle, or any kind of a change management process, it's key that you take data from the entirety of the process. The Air Force uses a process we used to call the OODA loop, the Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. So if I'm going to change a situation, I want to observe the situation, I want to orient myself to the issues, I want to make a decision, I want to take action. Then immediately I'm going to go back to observing again. But if I'm only looking at a small portion of the process, my data and my results will be skewed, because I have to understand as a system of systems and analysis as to what impacts everything. We had the Air Force operational analyst come in, and that's what this person does for the Air Force, is he looks at processes from A to B and then looks for statistical issues with them to find problems, to look for better efficiencies. So you must consider your process from A to Z, all the way through it. Again, your current process does that. So the assumption that there's a problem with your current protocol, I would challenge. The assumption that the RLA has been, as described by Dr. Stark, explicitly stating that computers aren't perfect, therefore they shouldn't be involved in calculation, I would challenge that. And thirdly, I would challenge that your protocol, since it covers from A to B, is more than sufficient and meets all your statutory requirements. Sir.
Hi, this is Dwight Shulman. I do have one question. I've, as you know, we've received a great number of written comments in the last 24 hours, which is not unusual. I have tried to read through all the comments to the best of my ability. I do not recall in either Clerk and Recorder Klotz's comments or in your separate written comments that you provided the math by which you reached the conclusion that the current protocol yields a 99 point whatever percent. I'd be interested in the math.
Yes, sir.
The comment is open. Comment period remains open after today.
Yes,
and
sir.
I'd invite you to explain to us exactly how you came to that conclusion.
I will do that. There, and one of the, I think it was Exhibit B or C, there's actually a paper by Dr. Horton, which explains that in more detail. But I'll be more than happy to get you more detail and get that to you, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kyle Ruley.
I'm Kyle Ruley with Douglas County, Elections Technology and Logistics Supervisor. Just to echo some of the comments that were made by Brett and Merlin, our current audit process is an audit of the voting system that's described by Stark and Lindemann as inherent and inherently by the Secretary of State's office, who has adopted their paper as rule, as software that cannot be guaranteed to be perfect or secure. These are the voting systems that are tested and certified by the Secretary of State's office. Our recent investigation into the added costs of these new audits vary greatly, depending on the number of ballots required to poll. Given the 3-day or so time constraint due to the times imposed by these rules, we had to take that into account in our estimation of the time and cost to conduct the RLA with Canvas, and how many people it would take to need or to keep it within that 3-day time frame. For reference, we completed our post-election audit for the 2016 general in just a couple hours. In races with wide margins where maybe we only need to look at 50 ballots, that audit could be very similar to the current post-election audit. But in a close margin race where maybe 2,000 ballots need to be looked at, we have to keep it within that few-day time frame, and our costs for staff could jump up to $9,000 to conduct this. We know that the rules say that the Secretary is going to take into account factors that will balloon the time and money required to complete the audit, but not all of our counties vote the same. Then there's the issue of if we have to go to a hand count, which will impose a much less accurate result, as Stark had mentioned in his paper, and even more costs on the counties. If that 2,000 ballot audit were to not satisfy the risk limit, it could end up being an over $30,000 hand recount on 180,000 ballots. The Secretary of State training even mentions that a hand count is not as accurate as the voting system. There's several questions still surrounding this theory, and I'm pretty nervous about Colorado being the first to conduct it on a large scale. And I'm pretty concerned about communicating this theory to the public and being able to convince them that it's better than what we had before.
Questions? No. Okay, thank you. Dan Volkosh.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Dan Volkosh. I'm with the Denver Elections Division. As always, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment on these proposed rules. We do appreciate it. We do very much understand that it's kind of an impossible task to write a rule that makes everybody happy. So we would like to say thank you very much. We are happy with proposed rules 215.1, 7210, rule 14, 18.5.3, and 2017.3. Obviously, we've already submitted some written comments in response to the proposed rules, so it's not my intention to regurgitate those written comments. I would just like to walk you guys through some of the issues we continue to spot as we go through the rules. That takes us to Rule 2.5.4. As we've mentioned in the written comments, we are a little concerned about how this proposed rule lines up with 12218.5. We think there is a little bit of a conflict there with the statute. Given our position, we would then like to know what exactly we should do with a declaration affiliation from an unaffiliated elector after that elector has submitted or cast a primary ballot but before Election Day. That same logic holds for a ballot a declaration of party preference by an unaffiliated elector within that same time frame. That kind of segues into some more general questions we have also about affiliation and party preference. We would like to know about voters associated with a qualified political organization. Obviously, the Unity Party has become a minor party, but I think traditionally they've always been kind of looped into unaffiliated electors, and given the substantial rewrite of these laws, we think this might be a good opportunity to address exactly how a county clerk should handle these folks for a primary election. Also, I mean, we just kind of see a loophole with this one, but for people who want to withdraw the registration entirely in order to get around the affiliation requirement and then re-register very quickly before Election Day. We would like to highlight the issue of what counties should do in the event an elector has submitted a preference for a major party and that major party subsequently loses its major party status. So, for instance, we had ACP as a major party for 4 years. If that major party then becomes a minor party, what should we do with all the people that have already declared their preference for that major party? And we have the same concern about people who have declared a party preference for a major party, and that major party subsequently decides to select its nominees through the assembly process. Staying on Rule 2.5.4, obviously, if you disagree with our concern about it conflicting with the statute, we are still concerned about tying this deadline to the date which counties mail ballots. That's obviously 22 to 18 days, so that's a four-day window. And then under 1.7.5.107, if that 22nd day does fall on a legal holiday, Sunday, something like that, that actually gets extended to the Friday before. So we could be working with almost a solid week where counties could have very different dates at which they mail ballots, and we don't think it's very equitable to have some electors in some counties being able to affiliate and some electors in other counties not being able to. That just moves me to my second general comment. As I mentioned before, we totally get it's very hard to write a rule that makes everybody happy, but we do get concerned every once in a while that the rules are extraordinarily precise, and we just want to make sure that we are kind of ensuring that counties can come up with innovative or efficient procedures in order to comply with these rules. So for an example of a rule that we actually like is 7210. An example of a rule that gives us a little bit of heartburn is 7514. We just want to make sure that counties can still innovate some of these procedures. And then moving on, proposed rule 7.5.11. We have a few concerns about this rule. We think this rule really assumes that all of the signatures are exposed on the back of the envelopes. That is not true for our county. We have a flap that covers the signatures. And we are not excited about the idea of other counties removing that flap in order to scan and send those along to us. Additionally, we are just kind of concerned if the USPS or if we FedEx them to the counties overnight, what happens if those packets get lost or not delivered to the correct county, and then that county has possibly already sent a cure letter to these people. The voters might be under the assumption their ballot is counted, but there might be problems with the packets though, like the possibility of two voted ballots, no ballots, or something like that. And those are really just the general comments we have.
All right. Any questions? No. Will you hang tight just a minute?
Yeah. I have just one question on Rule 2.5.4.
Mm-hmm.
Is Denver's proposal to, so let's assume somebody is unaffiliated on the 18th day prior. They've been sent a mail ballot.
Mm-hmm.
They thereafter submit an affiliation declaration.
Correct.
That is your proposal that the county should then process that affiliation and send them another affiliated ballot packet?
Yeah, we recognize that what having this rule be like totally in line with statute isn't really going to come up with a very good process. But we just think because the statute is kind of clear on this that they should be able to declare an affiliation. If there's a way that if we haven't already received their mail ballot, we can send them a ballot. But obviously that brings up some issues with now the elector having possibly three ballots in their possession. But if there's a way that we can just void out their ballot or cancel it and not even send it to them if we've already received it, that is a possibility. We completely recognize the law doesn't help us.
So I guess, I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. My concern is that you send a person who is unaffiliated on the 18th day an unaffiliated packet. Mm-hmm. I'll just pick one. They return the Democratic ballot, subsequently return a Republican Party affiliation. Mm-hmm. How in the world is a county expected to process that?
I mean, well, if they've already submitted their ballot back to us, we wouldn't give them a ballot.
Right, but they're now affiliated with the party that they're not eligible to vote, and they've already voted. I think we all understand the logistics.
We completely understand that's a problem, but we just think that's a statutory problem, not a rule problem.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
J.M. Fay? Ben, can you come up and read her statement?
Let me read this for you. Okay. This is J.M. Fay. She represents herself. Two issues here. How is the pilot project going to work for sharing vote centers, and how do citizens have input in how the decision is made? How is the cost going to be shared? How are you going to ensure counties are paying their fair share and not simply hogging other counties' facilities and too lazy to have their own facilities or staff and handle their own voters? Yes, we read the rule, but as someone who lives in unincorporated and who has to deal with Denver and Aurora not paying their fair share of library services for their own libraries and coming to use our Arapaho Library District, we can see Denver doing this with the vote centers, as we know where they are for Denver and Arapaho, and these two counties are intertwined in a lot of areas. Can you consider a form for unaffiliated voters which allows them to completely opt out of getting a ballot for the primaries? We can see, due to how 305 was rammed down, Senate Bill 305 was rammed down, and the fact we no longer have a secret ballot, because if you are going to put on the voter files, we ask for this, for the party's ballot, for this party's ballot or that one. This ballot is no longer secret, deciding not to vote. This would, of course, not affect getting a ballot in the general election and would save some money.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions? Dwight? Oh, okay. All right. Jason Dunn.
Good morning. Jason Dunn on behalf of Let Colorado Vote, the proponents of Propositions 107 and 108. First, I want to thank the Secretary of State's office and the Deputy Secretary for your work with our group in both the ballot initiative process, the legislative process, but particularly the rulemaking process and leading up to the draft rules. And it's clear that the draft rules that have come out have tried to take into consideration our concerns in effectuating the will of the voters in allowing unaffiliated voters to participate in primary elections, and ensuring that what I think is our primary issue in the rulemaking process, ensuring that ballots are not unduly spoiled through some verification process. So with that, I won't reiterate what's in our written comments, but I do want to highlight just four things. So with regard to Rule 2.17, which obviously says that allows unaffiliated voters to state a ballot preference, a party preference, and that it would only be good for that one particular primary, we support that. Our only request is that you make clear that in years in which there is also a presidential primary, that the preference only inure to either the presidential primary or the state primary, and that the unaffiliated voter would be given the option to, if they do so in the first one, to do so or not in the second one in the same year. With regard to rules 7.210, which says that obviously if the county may elect or select a process for designating or creating an envelope which allows them to determine which ballot is being returned, and then the overlay with that with 7.513, which creates the process for election judges to determine which ballot was returned. We like that process and appreciate that, and we think that's a good methodology to reduce spoilage. It appears that it's set up to create a fail-safe so that if, regardless of what method a county chooses, that the election judges, as a fail-safe, can determine what the voter intent was and which ballot was returned. And we think it would be helpful just to make that a little bit more clear as to that's the process of having the election judges is where the voter and which ballot is returned by the voter is not explicit on the envelope, that they can then use that process to make sure so that spoilage can be avoided. With regard to 7513, the only other point I'd make on that is that now that unaffiliated voters are likely going to be a significant portion of the voting electorate in primaries, that it makes sense to include them as part of the election judge teams, and that we'd like to see unaffiliated voters be eligible to participate in the in that process. And lastly, with regard to comment 7514, in situations where more than one ballot is returned, we again appreciate that the election judges can determine which one was voted, and we don't disagree with it. If a person fills out more than one ballot, that then both are spoiled. But in a situation where, which I think may happen, where somebody votes one but then also returns the blank one, that the election judges, I think the rule says that they will then evaluate that, determine which one was voted, and mark that in the score system. Maybe it would be stating the obvious, but just also say that then that ballot would be counted for purposes of counting their vote. Those are the only comments I'll add to our written comments, unless you have any questions.
I guess my only question is about the unaffiliated judges. I don't know that we have authority to do that.
I thought about that. It may need a statutory change. But
okay, yeah.
We would appreciate, obviously, the office supporting that if that's the case.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Mike Fulton.
Hi, I'm Mike Fulton, not affiliated with anybody. So I guess my first comment was on 2.54, the 29-day rule. It seems like that's an awful long time. And I think when I listen to the testimony based on other people, the problem that you're trying to do is affiliate a voter so that they can vote in the primary. And I think I might have a simple solution that maybe makes this a lot easier. So what if you just had one ballot? On one side it had the Democratic primary, the other side it had the Republican primary. You send that one ballot to a voter, and then they can only vote on one side, and they return it. The election judge then reviews it, sends it to whichever party that they can, that is appropriate, and then you do it that way. That solves the problem with affiliating the voter up to the day in effect, they can affiliate that day. So that's my suggestion. As far as rule 2.13.2, I think there should be that removing the requirement is a bad idea. There should be a log of any new registered voters and changes to the voting voters registrations. And then I forget which particular one this one was, but having cell phones in the voter when you're reviewing the vote tabulations, I think that's critical, because if you see an irregularity, you need to be able to contact and you need to be able to be in there and witness what is going on without having to go to your car and then potentially something else could occur. And then under cross-jurisdictional voting, I'm concerned that that would confuse and potentially close some voting access that I think is all critical to our democracy. So thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Ramona Ellis.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I would also like to thank the Secretary of State's office generally for providing so much opportunity for vigorous debate and comment on this particular issue. As a voter, I definitely appreciate democratic process and transparency in these sorts of things. I would like to begin by just first stating that casting a ballot remains the defining act of American citizenship. Especially since the election of 2000 with the precarious hanging chads that we had. I would add even more so now that we are completely immersed in this, you know, Russian tampering, whatever you want to call it. Many people are worried that voting in America is in shambles. Even it's a sham to some people. Some people think our democracy is broken and crippled by confusing, illegible, and deceptive ballot measures. So what I would first like to talk about today is 2.5.4. I'm certainly not going to beat a dead horse on this. I think that there are people who are certainly more experienced than me on this topic that have provided some excellent commentary. Mr. Volkosch and both Mr. Dunn have expressed most of the concerns that I have. I would just further support that in anything that we decide to do here with this ballot, and specifically how a person designates themselves within a primary, that we be as clear as possible when writing these rules so that voters will understand that. I consider myself to be a person of reasonable intelligence, and I had to really read and understand this and read a lot of comments to figure out what was happening here. So to the extent that we can make this so that the average voter understands exactly how this is going to impact them if they are an unaffiliated voter, I think it just needs to be abundantly clear and with as little confusing language as possible. Secondly, I would like to comment further on the amendment to 2.13.12 related to the voter registration logs. I guess my question, and you know, obviously is rhetorical at this point, is what the need for removing access or removing the log is for the election watcher. The election watcher, you know, under Rule 8.4.2, which is not being amended whatsoever, the election watchers have a variety of functions and obligations that that are all designed to help ensure the honesty and integrity of the electoral process. I think it's important that we continue to support that. I'm not quite sure what the purpose of removing access to voter registration information and such would be. One of the things that comes up often with election watchers is that they are monitoring to make sure that people who are asked to provide identification that don't need to be identified, that's something that they can address. Or if there's a translation issue or something, just an irregularity generally. So I would just like more clarification on why that's necessary.
Why don't we go? We got a lot of comments on that, so why don't we go ahead and do that, and then that way, if you have any follow-up, you can
include
it. Go ahead, Melissa.
So, yeah, I'd just like to clarify the removal of 2.13.2 in the rules is not going to remove the provision of that information to anyone. It's an update of how we now conduct elections in that we don't have polling locations where they're keeping a log and providing those one-off to watchers. Those are now reports that our office runs, provides to county clerk and recorders on an hourly basis, and are public. And so anyone can still receive those reports. It's just the way in which they're collected, and this rule kind of no longer reflects our current processes.
That makes a lot more sense.
Because everything is
no, it would have been
right. Everything is statewide and computerized now, and so those new registrations are done in real time through our system. And so we no longer have, you know, just like we don't have voters being checked off in a poll book, you know, as they enter a polling place, you know, vote credit is now in score. And so it would be akin to having a rule that would have talked about, you know, providing the poll book with the checkoff marks.
Duplicate.
That doesn't exist. Yeah, the process just doesn't really exist that way anymore. And so this rule is being updated to reflect that. It is not an attempt to lessen any information that anybody's given.
Excellent. Okay, so then I guess moving on to, I think it is 8. Let me share right here. 8.15.8 with relation to the mobile devices. I am certainly in favor of anything that is going to protect the confidentiality of voters' information. I would just caution that a comment that has already been made, voters, an election watcher is going to need to be able to have some sort of access. I can see a situation, I think, that someone from possibly the Colorado Democratic Party had submitted comment related to the possibility that a judge could potentially interpret the area in which a watcher has their cell phone in a way that would be disadvantageous to the watcher, depending on what you consider an area that would have confidential voting information. So I think I would just prefer some clarity on that. And then finally on cross-jurisdictional voting, and I'm sorry if I'm murdering that name, I think that my concern is a concern that's already been voiced. I am all for widening the opportunity for people to vote, especially if you work in Denver and you live in Arapahoe. But there are people who live in unincorporated Arapahoe County. And my understanding from reading this particular section was that the county that is adjacent to you would contract with you, but not every county who's adjacent to you has to contract with you. So if you are in unincorporated Arapahoe County and the county that is contracted with you is Denver County, it does you no good if you lose part of the precincts in your voting jurisdiction just to be able to go and drive to Denver to vote. I don't want to do anything that would decrease the opportunity for people to be able to cast their ballot. So as long as we can ensure that that's not something that would happen to those particular people, I'm concerned about rural Coloradans here. I don't live in rural Colorado, but, you know, I definitely care about those people, making sure that they are just not going to lose any opportunity to participate in this process. That is it.
All right. Thank you. And Derota or Devota Wright O'Neill, I can't tell if that's a V or R.
The clarification of 2.1.3.2 sort of made my comment moot.
Oh, okay, okay.
I will cede my spot.
All right, thank you. Neil Burnett.
Good morning. I'm Neil McBurnett. I've been an election integrity consultant and have run audits in Colorado for over 12 years, including the first risk-limiting audit in outside of California and many, many others, working with clerks and the Secretary of State's office for a long time. I'm also working with the Free and Fair team. This is a company in Portland that just won the contract to write the software behind the risk-limiting audits. And I'm excited to do that, but today I'm speaking on my own behalf. I'm very proud to be a citizen of Colorado and seeing widespread support for and implementation of risk-limiting audits. I've worked towards this goal diligently since in 2002 when I became an election judge in Boulder, Colorado. Risk-limiting audit implementation here puts Colorado at the forefront of a national movement for increased election integrity. As we've all seen in the news, the evidence is abundant that not only are there occasional glitches that can get past existing safeguards in the system, but we now all know that state-level adversaries are trying to change our election outcomes, as they have done in other countries. So this is a historic move, exactly the right thing to do at this time. I know the statistical and security underpinnings of risk-limiting audits can be confusing, and we need to pay close attention to detail and science. I strongly disagree with the testimony of the three officials from Douglas County who suggest that the existing Colorado audit process is better than the risk-limiting audits required by law in Colorado. The security framework and statistical background behind risk-limiting audits has been supported over many years by the Presidential Commission on Election Administration, the American Statistical Association, the League of Women Voters, the Verified Voting Foundation, Common Cause, and other organizations concerned with election integrity. There is simply no question that risk-limiting audits in combination with compliance audits, as we do in current auditing for other parts of the election process, are far better than the existing tabulation audits. Please read the detailed written testimony from senior members of the American Statistical Association and other experts referring to their testimony. The main thing that I think should be clarified in the rule and in the practice is taking advantage of what I call opportunistic auditing. Election auditing and security and statistic experts from around the country have provided written input on the importance of doing some auditing of all the contests. And here I actually agree with the folks from Douglas County. We need to continue, as we have for many years, to include all contests in the audit. An audit of a single contest doesn't actually give you the evidence that we're looking for other contests. So opportunistic auditing is one very efficient way to do that. Please refer to the submissions from Mark Lindemann on behalf of the group of experts around the country that have been consulting with the Secretary of State, actually since 2009. Let me just clarify that a little bit. In a ballot-level risk-limiting audit, each and every individual paper ballot has an associated cast vote record that indicates how the system interpreted it originally. And in the audit, we select ballots and we compare them to the originally tabulated records, which is different than the existing audit, where we don't generally check against the actual original records as cast. And we look for discrepancies, and we look for agreement. And every time that we get an agreement between a ballot and the cast vote record, that is evidence that we're making progress with the audit and are reducing the risk that there is an incorrect outcome. So in a risk-limiting audit, we'll choose some contests and have them meet a risk limit. But at the same time, we can look at those ballots that are chosen, that are selected, and with just a little bit of extra work, because we're only talking dozens or maybe hundreds, unless it's a very close election, of ballots that need to be checked, we can look at the other contests and see if they also match the originally reported results. So by doing that, we get evidence on all the contests. It isn't a lot more work. We've already made the election auditing far more efficient than it is in the existing scheme, except in those cases where the existing scheme doesn't give us very good confidence because a contest is so close. So I just, again, want to thank the state for really making historic progress in the auditing of tabulations of election equipment. We all know that's very important, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or provide any other input.
Do you have questions? Sorry. No? All right. Thank you very much. Skip Madsen.
Good morning. My name is Skip Madsen. I'm here on my own behalf, but I'm also here as the executive director of DEM Enter Colorado, DEM, capital ENTER, Colorado. We are a burgeoning new nonprofit, just filling out our information with you folks. but we've been around since right after the Democratic Convention last year. Our main concern is making sure that everybody gets a chance to affiliate or unaffiliate and vote. So most of my comments will be very general in terms of how the state secretary state's office goes about its business. I know you guys are very hardworking. You have an awful lot that you have to do. I've actually done some of the things that you are doing now. Working in administrations, working in an executive department. My main concern is that Colorado is one of the best states in the country, and I applaud everyone who is part of that in making sure that people get the access to their vote. We want to make sure that that continues. 107 and 108 was specifically voted in so that people who were unaffiliated would have the opportunity to vote. My concerns have been expressed to some extent, both from the gentleman from Denver and other people here today, about specifically 2.5.4. Our concern is, according to statute, that people get the opportunity to change their affiliation up to the day of voting. We want to make sure that that continues to happen, even with the mail-in ballots. Our other concerns have to do with a little bit of the poll watching, which you explained a little bit more in detail. However, I have been in instances during the elections when I was a poll watcher and I was pushed so far away from what was going on that I had no opportunity to really be able to watch the polls. I don't want that to happen. Sometimes there are more problems in some of the more rural counties than the urban counties. I understand that. Sometimes it depends on the community that you're in within the urban area. My experience and many of my colleagues' experiences, both in the Colorado Democratic Party as well as Dem Inter Colorado, says that as good as Colorado is, we can do better. My concern is about that whole thing, about the poll watching. I understand that you don't actually have a book anymore, that you actually cross out the names. I realize that. I know you're going more and more electronic. I applaud that because I think it makes it easier in the long run for people to be able to vote. However, my concern is also that we as individuals, as voters, as electors, have the opportunity to be able to understand what you're doing a little bit more clearly. Quite honestly, there's always a disconnect between you getting your information out in a way that everybody can pick up on it and people being able to pick up on it and actually do something about it, like presenting themselves here today or in other ways. I'm glad to hear that the opportunity for comments has been extended. I think that's great. I applaud that. I ask you to hold off, please, making any serious changes in the rules until more and more people have had the opportunity to speak, but also, more importantly, to understand what's going on. We're more than willing to work with you on doing that. We will publicize this thing to the nth degree. I and many of us represent literally over 1 million Colorado voters. We want to make sure that all those people have the opportunity to understand whether they actually take that opportunity or not is another question, but we want them to have the opportunity to understand the rules that you are trying to change to make things better. I understand and I accept that, but everybody needs to have an opportunity to know what that is. That's pretty much everything I have to say.
Right. You have something?
Yeah, just real quick, because I you know, when we do a notice of rulemaking, we're really giving you the rules that we're thinking of changing, adding,
right,
deleting. We don't provide you the whole set of rules.
Right.
And I just want you to know that rule 8.10.2, which is not one of the rules that we're touching in this rulemaking,
right,
really clearly provides that watchers must be given access to personally observe all election-related activities. So I do think that we've covered that, and nothing in these rules is intended to take away from that. The restriction on cell phones is just understand that election judges work real time now in the statewide voter registration database, which contains an enormous amount of really confidential personal information that nobody other than an election judge needs to see. And understanding that cell phones, every cell phone in the world now has a camera, we just want to be sensitive to the voters' confidential information and protect that. The restriction on cell phones only applies in areas where confidential information in the voter registration database is visible. So I do think that we are trying to accommodate both the transparency and the interests of the watchers, but also the expectations of privacy on confidential information of voters.
May I just say that I agree with you on that. Having been a person who was a watcher for balloting many, many, many times, when cell phones first came out, they became a difficulty, especially when they ended up having cameras. We make sure in the party and other groups that I work with that that's not possible when people are watching the polls. They don't have access to their cell phones. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is sometimes the practicalities of implementing what is supposed to be statute and rules doesn't always necessarily happen at the local level. That's part of what our process is about. That's part of our mission, to help you get that information out to everybody that needs to hear it. I'm not saying that. My concern is that implementation of the existing rules, how that changes with this change that you are talking about. I guess I'm just leery of anything that's going to possibly make it more difficult for poll watchers to do their job and to do it legitimately. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Harvey Branscombe.
Okay. Thank you very much. Harvey Branscombe from Carbondale, Eagle County, a place where multi-county VSPCs actually would be very effective because during a two-mile stretch of Highway 82, there are three different counties. And in fact, you have to go to the correct county in order to vote, which is very unfortunate considering people are driving up and down this stretch of road near my house all the time. The risk-limiting audit is going to be a big win for us, and I want to quickly put a big plug for that. I actually introduced Philip Stark to the then Senate Majority Leader, Ken Gordon, many years ago now. And ever since then, we have basically been working in the direction of something that's about to implement this year. It's very, very exciting. It's a tabulation audit. It's a tabulation solution. It's going to focus on details we haven't focused on before. And we're going to learn things about our election in the course of that. We're going to be looking at our voter history file, which actually will be part of what amounts to a ballot manifest. And I've been looking at it and discovering that there are duplications in the voter history file. There are places where voters appear to have voted in person and also by mail. And also, by the way, I hear stories from clerks that there are cases where voters have voted twice in Colorado. They don't generally reach the public eye because they tend to be shared among election officials or not shared at all, but that's the kind of thing you will hear as a watcher if you go to a canvas board meeting, which I have done on many occasions. So I watched in about 35 different counties during the 2016 election alone. And that's only possible in Colorado because of the length of time we actually operate our election and the fact that it's possible to get appointed by the Libertarian Party or the Green Party to watch in all counties. We will see the limitations of SCORE. SCORE, the registration database, actually isn't capable of looking back at a specific date and time and getting data out of itself. It's constantly changing. And the result of it constantly changing means we are going to find discrepancies between ballots that have come in, voters that are actually no longer eligible to vote on some of the contests on those ballots. But we have opportunities to actually solve those problems as we gradually find them. We're going to be focusing on adjudication. Adjudication is now happening on screens. screens are actually reflecting an imperfect view of a paper ballot. And we're going to be, the audit's actually looking at the outcome. It's going to be confirming the outcome based on the tabulation, not on other considerations like eligibility. But it's very important that it actually focuses on the outcome rather than just the accuracy of the voting system. These scans are not the same as ballots. Scans, actually, as Dwight told me recently, we're going to continue with red dropouts, so the targets that are printed on the ballots will not appear in the scans of the ballots. And the ballot scans are one bit per pixel, which means they're not color, they have no grayscale. So that's why we're actually auditing paper. We have to audit the paper, not the scans. About watchers, I'm a very experienced watcher. I've used a cell phone in watching in order to time the time it takes to signature verify, the kind of data which the election system doesn't capture, and it really should, because it's nice to know which signatures were actually taking a long time to verify and which ones weren't. There was a rule recently, or the rule currently actually calls for election judges and staff and other personnel to perform registration changes at VSPCs. This is unfortunate considering that there was an agenda by the Secretary of State's office and others to produce a bill that would limit watching to only the times when election judges are actually working. So there's a big inconsistency there. I'm very troubled by it. That's why I worked for 3 weeks to try to stop that bill, and the bill actually did not pass out of the legislature, fortunately, and I hope if it ever comes back, it comes back in another form, and we've provided there are legislative language now out there which would provide a better opportunity for watching than what we have now. We need to collect detailed data. There's the issue of 213.2 that actually now says that watchers don't get the list at the polling center. It doesn't say that exactly, right? It says but in any case, it's about records. It's about records going to watchers. And the presumption is, what we've heard today, is that there are alternative mechanisms for that. The alternative mechanisms actually come from the Secretary of State. They cost money. They take time to get. And they may be inaccurate or incomplete, as I have experienced. And I don't want to go into detail now, but you can ask me about it. Also about watching, the Senate Bill 305 actually calls for capturing the party style. And what I'm hoping for is that's an opportunity to actually capture the ballot style. And if we use an envelope with a window in it, it actually looks through to the ballot. That's a very wonderful thing to do for election integrity. It allows us to know which ballot styles are actually coming back. And that can be used for the purpose of sorting by style, which is something that benefits us in terms of anonymity of the ballots and about audit efficiency and for purposes of recount. So that's why my written testimony, which I'm not describing here today, actually includes a lot of talk about sorting by style and reporting by style. So where do we go from here? Actually, the score system and signatures is an area where we need to focus more attention once we're literally solving the problem of confidence about the tabulation of the election. That means this set of ballots produces this outcome. And yes, we are going to know if we perform this audit properly, we will know that that's the case in almost every instance. And there are very few instances set by the risk limit in which it might not be the case. However, we don't know whether the eligibility has been checked properly or not. That involves watching the signature verification. That's what I've been doing recently, thanks to new rules that actually allow us to get access to those. And I highly encourage people doing watching to actually focus on the eligibility check portion of the election, because it's as important as the tabulation portion. So we're going to need eventually an audit of eligibility. I'm just putting that out in front of you. It's something it's going to maybe take us years. It took us 10 years or more to get to this audit, so maybe another 10 years.
You're pretty well over on your time. So if you have something related to the rules, I mean, I understand you have lots of plans for future rules, but yeah. If you could bring it back to what we have on the table.
Okay. The Russian hacking stories that are coming out are focusing attention on what about voter privacy. And we need to focus on that. We have in this rule a reiteration of the definition of personal identifiable information. I proposed three different definitions for different purposes, which would separate out signatures, separate out things that can be seen by watchers but can't be taken home. I think it's important to actually, I provided those in my previous rule comments, not the ones that went in yesterday. We need to focus on security of envelope sorters and the fact that it's uncertified software. And we need to think about the integration of recount. And I know some of the comments that came in on the rules were wondering from the clerks why there's no mention of recount. We do actually need to have, we were very lucky, you could say, not to have a major recount in 2016. But if we do have a recount, we're going to have to make a hybrid a rule to help clerks actually understand how to perform that recount based on the fact they've already done the risk-limiting audit. Will the risk-limiting audit actually touch every ballot that actually is with the contest on it, which is a reason why we need to move towards sorting by style. So I mentioned the multi-county VSBC, the cell phone issue, and the, so just 10 more seconds or 20 seconds. The Klotz-Merz Ruley testimony at the beginning suggests that there's a lack of evidence, there's a problem. That is the problem, actually. We need more evidence. We need evidence-based elections. That's what we're working towards. That's what this RLA brings us to in terms of the tabulation. And I have actually experienced an election in Eagle County where the logic and accuracy test failed to discover a major problem. The audit would have failed to find a major problem, and that problem consisted of ballots being tested without being folded, but after having been tested, being folded, sent through the mail, where the toner that was on these were Diebold created ballots, was actually transferred across onto some of the targets in a way that wasn't really easy to see by human eye, but the voting system actually detected those particles of toner as votes and turned a very much undervoted election into a very incorrect election. And I was ironically a candidate in that election. But that's just an example of how it is possible that we do actually have problems in our elections. Very difficult to find ones, but this audit would actually find those. That's why we're doing it. It's crucial. Thanks. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thanks. All right.
Any questions?
Nancy Nixon.
Hello, I'm Nancy Nixon with ACLU People Power, and I also represent Arvadans for Progressive Action. I have been an election judge for probably 12 elections here in Colorado, and I've always been very proud as I travel around the country and around the world, talking with other democracies, other nations where there is no freedom to vote or choose your leaderships. And when I describe how Colorado carries out its elections, they are amazed at how hard we come together as a state to protect our voting rights. I'd like to clarify that I'm not an attorney for the ACLU. I'm with People Power. We're a community organization who participates in many of the activities of the community, both legislative and in committee, to make sure that the constitutional rights, civil rights of all people are honored and that the Constitution is obeyed. And with that, we are, of course, in the business of guaranteeing a private vote, that our votes are not witnessed by everyone who wants to have access to that. So with that being said, I'm going to just basically read some statements and add a little bit of a comment here in a second. Regarding Amendment 2.5.4, we'd like to have a little bit of clarification on this amendment. The amended rule must clarify that in election years of both presidential and state primaries, the party affiliation of the voter only applies to a single primary in the election cycle and not all the primaries in the cycle. Amended Rule 2.13.2. We reject this amendment, which would eliminate the requirement of election judges to maintain a log of new registered voters. or any changes made to by the register electors. These actions are critical to maintaining the integrity of fair and honest elections. We feel that there must be a physical record which could verify the digital results in case of a question. Regarding Rule 8, that we also reject this amendment, which would not allow poll watchers to have an electronic device or mobile phone in their possession in the vicinity of the polling place. This is problematic because without these, watchers would be unable to report voting irregularities in real time.
Well, it's not the polling place. It's places where there's confidential information. So
in the polling places, there would be an opportunity. So there's a misunderstanding amongst the community with the Secretary of State's office on that issue.
I think there is, because we're only limiting cell phones in places where highly sensitive personal information is kept and stored. And so, for instance, in Tier 2 of signature verification, there are multiple score screens that pop up. And we want watchers to have access to those screens, but those screens have last four digits of SSN. They have other kinds of personal information, and we're trying to balance the voters' privacy with the watcher's ability to watch. And so in a world where you can shoot a video and nobody knows you're doing it, it's something we're trying to balance. But in the majority of areas in a polling place, there's not going to be a prohibition on cell phones. And in the majority of area, even in the tabulation center where envelopes are being separated or other activities are happening, cell phones are permitted. There's still a ban on photography, but we're at least operating on the presumption in those areas that people will follow the rule and not take photographs unless they're media and they have exceptions for that. And you know, but we do have to have something to protect that highly sensitive information, so that voters have confidence that, you know, it's not being distributed widely.
You know, having had poll watchers around me for so many elections, these tend to be the most common issues that a lead judge will deal with. There are typically 8 to 10 people within a 10-foot circle around that judge when any voter comes in and there is a question about whether they have the right to vote at that polling place. The Secretary of State has always trained and retrained again, and it's the number one rule is that anyone who comes in and wants to cast a vote can cast a vote. So we can do it by paper, a provisional vote. At that moment, the poll watchers are very concerned that there might be a double vote going on there. The process requires that they show some sort of identification. We go ahead and take the provisional vote by paper. We have not only is the lead election judge guiding that voter through the process, but there is a judge on either side of the aisle.
Right, but as a practical matter, we don't do many provisionals anymore because we have same-day voter registration. So all those provisional votes, that's just not the process in Colorado. That was always for people who walked in and we couldn't find their registration. Now that person simply registers.
They can go to any polling place and register right then and there.
Yes, same-day voter registration has allowed that, and so our provisional numbers are almost zero now in Colorado.
Do they have to do that in their own county or their own?
Their own county.
So there is a disconnect there for someone, say, who works out at the airport and lives over in Golden. That person would be denied their opportunity to vote?
Well, they can do it for 22 days up until, I mean, they get a ballot in the mail, too. But yes. Then if they want to vote in person, they just need to go to any location within their county, or depending on what we do with cross-jurisdictional, perhaps in a neighboring county.
Well, typically we just have very few provisional votes, but there are those people who are new to the election process. There are elderly people that with all the changes that we do from election to election, they get confused. I'm just not sure if that couldn't use a little bit more examination as to how to include that.
Well, it's very clear that provisional ballots must be offered to voters if there's no other way to accommodate them.
Thank you.
Has not changed. What Suzanne was saying is that because Colorado now has vote centers, you don't have to go to a precinct polling place. You can go to any vote center in your county of residence. And because we also have same-day voter registration, just as a practical matter, the number of provisional ballots has dropped way, way down, which is a good thing.
It means those voters are voting
official ballots, not provisional ballots. But there are circumstances where provisional ballots are really still the only solution. And in that situation, county clerks must offer that voter a provisional ballot. Nobody leaves without having the opportunity to vote.
How does that affect the right of someone to have a cell phone? I mean, that seems to be the time, and as I recall all the elections that I've done, when the digital phones came out, that was when these poll watchers really wanted to video the action to make sure that I was doing everything according to the Colorado state law.
Well, they're not permitted to video anyway. I mean, we're not going to have a